Chapter 5
"Why, Mr. Koss,"
the stranger said, raising his hands over his head.
"Fancy meeting you here."
I couldn't see who was holding the gun from where I was standing. But sure enough, when I opened my door wider, Nick was standing in the old motel's open hallway, with his sleek gun pointed at the tanned man's temple.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked in a deadly voice.
"Same thing you are, I imagine,"
the man at my door replied. With remarkable calm, I thought, given the situation.
"Pursuing a business opportunity."
The stranger's sly brown eyes flicked back to me, and the brilliant white smile returned to his face.
"You're Miss Opal Yonge, correct? The cleaner?"
I glanced nervously at Nick, but he was keeping his eyes and his gun pinned on the newcomer. He looked more pissed off than worried, though, and I took that as a cue to play it cool. "Who's asking?" I said, opening my door all the way to show that I wasn't afraid. The tanned man smiled wider, which didn't seem physically possible.
"My name is Kaufman,"
he said, nodding at his chest.
"There's a business card in my front jacket pocket."
Which he couldn't get for me because he'd be shot if he moved. Sighing at the ridiculousness of it all, I dug my fingers into his pocket to grab the card. I made sure to press my knuckles into his chest as I did, giving him a good feel of the magic I'd instinctively pulled into my hands. It was supposed to be a warning, a rattle of my own to match Nick's pulled gun. To my surprise, though, the man was already buzzing with power when I touched him. It was a neat, orderly pulse, much better shaped than my sloppy handful. Apparently, this Kaufman was a mage as well, and not a bad one. Better than me, actually, which made me more grateful for Nick's gun as I stepped back into my apartment with the business card. "Andre Kaufman," I read, noting the expensive embossed printing, and more importantly, the tracking spell woven into the ecru cardstock. "President, Creative Solutions LLC. Magical Risk Management and Asset Recovery." That last one made me sweat a little, but I managed to keep the worry off my face, leaning casually on the doorframe so that my body blocked Kaufman's view of the bag full of the papers we'd taken from Dr. Lyle's house, which was still sitting on the coffee table not 3 feet behind me. "If you're here to recover something, I'm afraid you're out of luck," I said innocently, reaching out to tuck the bugged business card back into Kaufman's pocket. "I haven't found anything worth sending someone after in weeks. Just ask Nick. He knows how bad my luck's been, and you two seem to know each other."
"We're not friends,"
Nick said sharply, sliding his gun a bit closer to Kaufman's skull.
"He's a fixer. He helps corporations find criminals to do their dirty work."
"I prefer the term consultant,"
Kaufman said crisply, giving Nick a cutting look before turning his dazzling smile back on me.
"I understand you recently purchased the cleaning rights to a townhome in Magic Heights. Yes?"
I could have said no. Cleaning auctions weren't public record, but it was easy enough information to get. All he'd have to do was talk to any other cleaner, and they'd tell him all about my crazy bid. Kaufman also struck me as the sort of person who didn't ask a question unless he already knew the answer. So I nodded, and his smile grew even brighter.
"Excellent,"
he said, clapping his still-raised hands together above his head.
"I'd like to buy it from you. My employer has authorized me to offer you $100,000 for full rights to the house and everything therein. If you could just tell your attack dog to lower his weapon so I can use my phone, I'll be happy to transfer the full amount to your account immediately."
Nick looked more pissed at the dog comment than I'd ever seen him, but I was too shocked to pay his reaction proper attention. $100,000 was a lot of money, and immediately was definitely my kind of timeline. If I took his offer, I could pay my debt tonight. But eager as I was to get out of my current squeeze, I wasn't a total idiot. If Kaufman really was a fixer like Nick said, then he was undoubtedly the one who'd hired the guys who'd attacked me. He was also vastly overpaying, which told me the information I'd found in Dr. Lyle's home was worth a lot more than $100,000.
"Opal," Nick whispered,
but I held up my hand. "You're offering for the cleaning contract, right?" I said, choosing my words carefully. "Meaning you'd clean the house up and hand it back to the city, ready for a new tenant, in exchange for ownership of everything that's inside it right now?" Kaufman's eyes sharpened above his smile.
"Considering you've already been there, that wouldn't be a very good deal for me, would it?"
He shook his head.
"We're not making a new deal, Miss Junge. I'm offering $100,000 for your contract. Meaning I would own everything on the property from the moment you won it at auction, including any objects or papers you might have already salvaged. But I'm sure that won't be a problem,"
he added quickly.
"After all, you already said you found nothing of value for weeks, so selling all that nothing to me for a very nice profit should be a no-brainer. Right?"
He finished with a cheerful grin, but I was already shaking my head. Nick was as well.
"No deal,"
he said. Kaufman shot him a sideways look.
"I don't see how your opinion enters into this, Mr. Cuss."
"It enters because 60% of that contract is mine,"
Nick growled, keeping his gun up as he stepped around Kaufman to join me in the doorway.
"Opal and I already made a deal, and if you're throwing around that much money, all you're doing is telling us that what was in that property is worth a lot more."
He looked at me.
"Right."
"Damn right," I said, crossing my glowing hands over my chest. Kaufman shrugged and lowered his hands even though Nick's gun was still pointed at his head.
"That is your prerogative. But before you close the door, you should know that the previous tenant, Dr. Theodore Lyle, is a dangerous and deranged man."
I blinked in confusion at his use of the present tense, and that hit me. Kaufman was only trying to buy my cleaning contract on Dr. Lyle's townhouse. That meant he must not know about the basement I'd won this morning. Or that Dr. Lyle was dead.
"A dangerous man, huh?"
I said, keeping my face neutral.
"What's so bad about him?"
"He's a thief, for one,"
Kaufman said.
"He was a magical contractor for our mutual employer, but he absconded 6 weeks ago with some expensive and very dangerous property. I'm merely trying to get it back."
"If he's a thief, why didn't your client call the authorities?"
Nick asked.
"He's a man who greatly values his privacy,"
Kaufman replied innocently.
"Right,"
Nick said, giving me a pointed look. As if I needed the hint. This was obviously a case of criminals all the way down. But while I had no idea why Kaufman's client cared so much about a ritual that made cockatrice eggs, I now knew for certain that that spell was worth a lot more than $100,000. No one made money paying fair market price on a buyout. For Kaufman to show up this fast with a six-figure starting number, the actual value had to be multiple times that. Maybe even more than $1,000,000. My stomach began to flutter. Forget making my payment. 40% of $1,000,000 would clear all the money I owed to my father and then some. I just had to get my hands on it. And that meant getting rid of Kaufman. "Thank you so much for coming all the way out here, Mr. Kaufman," I said sweetly, trying not to cringe at how much I sounded like my mother. "But I'm afraid we can't do business. I have a previous arrangement with Mr. Koss, and I could never go back on a contract with a fellow cleaner."
"You really should reconsider,"
Kaufman said, the smile slipping from his face.
This is a one-time offer. I'd hate for you to miss it.
Sorry, but the answer is no, I said firmly, clenching my fists around the magic I'd packed so tight it was starting to burn my skin. Good night, Mr. Kaufman. Kaufman's perfect square jaw tightened as he realized I was serious. Nick tensed as well, his body still and hard as an iron post beside mine. To my enormous surprise, though, no violence broke out. Kaufman simply backed away.
A no is a no,
he said, charming smile right back in place as though it had never left.
I'm sorry we couldn't come to an agreement, Miss Yonge.
He nodded to Nick.
Mr. Koss.
Nick didn't answer. Neither did I. We just stood side by side in the doorway, watching Kaufman like hawks as he strolled away down the open hallway, whistling to himself in the hot, dark night. When he'd vanished down the stairs, Nick slammed my door.
You need to pack.
What?
Kaufman's a professional,
he said, holstering his gun.
He only asks nicely once. The next time it's going to be men through your window.
I gaped at him. Are you serious?
What part of this strikes you as a joke?
He demanded.
You've already been shot at once today by men Kaufman probably hired. You think he'll hesitate to do it again?
Not when you put it that way. Should we call the cops? I asked, grabbing my bag off the table and digging for my goggles, because if this was getting serious, I needed Sybil's eyes. Even in the DFZ, it's illegal to bust in through people's windows, right?
It is, Nick said. But DFZ police are all private security contractors. They practically have an 800 number for bribes, and given the number Kaufman's thrown around tonight, he's probably already paid.
I cursed under my breath. Sometimes I hated this city. So what do?
We run, Nick said,
nodding at my poncho, which was still lying in the center of its charging circle.
Is it done yet?
I walked over and stuck my hand in the circle to check. Almost, I said, swirling my fingers through what was left of the nearly absorbed magic. So what should I bring? Are we talking overnight, or days, or what? Nick shrugged.
Kaufman knows where you live now, so I'd say bring whatever you don't want smashed.
I froze, eyes going wide as I remembered the rubble they'd made of Dr. Lyle's house, and then imagined the same thing happening to mine. Oh no, I said, dangerously close to tears as I turned to my nearly empty shelves, the last treasures I had left. No, no, no. My reaction seemed to freak Nick out even more than the prospect of gunmen crashing through the window.
What's wrong?
He asked, voice slightly panicked.
Why are you crying?
I was not crying, though I did have to sniff a few times before I could answer. I don't want him to break my stuff. I know it's stupid and it's not worth much, but... I shook my head, pushing my goggles up so I could wipe my eyes. It's mine. That was all I could say. Before I'd come to the DFZ, nothing had been mine. Everything had belonged to my father, including me. I couldn't say that to Nick, though. I could already see him assessing my apartment as a cleaner would. I'd done the same myself countless times, and I knew what he was going to say. The stuff in my apartment wasn't worth $1,000 altogether. It was useless, pointless, sentimental junk. And I was an idiot for caring about it when so much more was on the line. I was telling myself to get a grip when Nick turned back to me.
We'll move it.
I stared at him, uncomprehending.
What?
We'll move your apartment,
he said, his face breaking into a rare smile.
We're cleaners, right? We do this all the time. I've only got my car, so we can't get the furniture, but we can do the rest. Just tell me what you want to save, and I'll help you get it out.
He said all of this quickly and confidently, but I still couldn't believe it.
I thought this was stupid, and I was the one who was upset about it. Nick had to think I was the biggest idiot on the planet for going to pieces over a bunch of quarter-full shelves. It would be in everyone's better interest for him to tell me to suck it up. But he was already grabbing the big empty box that my bulk order of cup noodles had arrived in.
It's the stuff on the shelves, right?
I nodded, unable to speak. He nodded back and started carefully but quickly packing my things into the box with a cleaner's efficiency. I stood there watching him for a good minute and a half before it hit me that if I wasn't being an idiot before, I was definitely being one now.
I'll do my room,
I said in a rush, grabbing a black trash bag from the box I kept in my closet before sprinting for my bedroom door.
Prioritize the ceramics. If it doesn't fit in that box, just leave it.
I can get it all,
Nick said confidently.
I do this all the time.
I could have hugged him right then. If I hadn't wasted so much time already, I would have fallen at his feet and thanked him from the bottom of my heart. It was such a small kindness. Just a few extra minutes. But while plenty of people had been kind to me in my life, no one had done it for as little as Nick had just now. I wouldn't have done it. I was already furious with myself over how selfish I was being. It was just junk. The unsellable dregs of a collection that had only taken me a year to put together. The only reason it mattered was because of my weird attachment issues. If Kaufman already had guys lined up in case we rejected his offer, I might have just gotten us killed over trinkets. Nick had to know that. And yet here I was, working to save my stuff without complaint or condemnation. I had no words for it. Thank you felt too shallow and cheap to attach to the big, formless emotions boiling inside me. So I said nothing at all. I just kept working, throwing whatever clothes and toiletries would fit into my trash bag as fast as I could. We had the whole place done in 10 minutes.
What did I tell you?
Nick said as he put the box containing the final bits of my collection and my trash bag full of clothes and toiletries into the trunk of his car.
Cleaner efficiency.
Thank you, I said, repeating the words even though I knew they weren't enough. Because really, what else could I say? Thank you so much. Nick shrugged and took the pre-printed magic circle I used to recharge my poncho from my hands. We'd finished before it had, but we'd already wasted too much time. So I'd declared my wards good enough and grabbed the whole thing, pulling the protective poncho over my head while Nick crammed the soft-ribbed spellwork-covered circle into his trunk and shut the lid.
Is that all?
It's everything I care about. My apartment wasn't empty, but I could buy more cheap furniture and packs of instant noodles. The stuff I couldn't replace. My salvaged block of limestone fronting engraved with 19th-century Masonic imagery. My ammonite fossil where you could see the full golden ratio spiral. My brass letter opener shaped like a crane that might have been a limited-edition Crane Paper Company retirement gift from the 1920s. Was all safely stowed in Nick's trunk. And I couldn't thank him enough. Thank you, I said again. Really, thank you.
It's fine,
he said, looking as awkward as I felt.
You're welcome. Now let's go. I don't want to push our luck any further than we already have.
I nodded and dove into the car, remembering to take my shoes off at the last minute, even though I was wearing my reasonably clean sneakers rather than my cleaning boots. I was still fastening my seatbelt when Nick hit the gas, shooting us out of the quiet parking lot like a bullet. He turned the moment he hit the street, almost fishtailing the car as he swung around and gunned it up the ramp toward the skyways. Wait, I said as he pushed us faster. Why are we going up? I thought the morgue was in the underground. And while you could get there through the skyways, the tolls were ridiculous.
We're not going to the morgue,
Nick said, eyes pinned on his rearview mirror as he wove us through the late-night traffic.
If Kaufman didn't smash a team through your window the moment he got to the parking lot, It's probably because he decided it would be easier to follow us to the prize instead. Which means I'm not going anywhere important until I'm certain I've lost any tails. When I know we're not being followed, we'll pull over, check the car for bugs, and then drive some more. Then we can head to where we're actually going.
I smiled at him, impressed. Good thinking.
Nick shrugged, a move I now recognized as his default for when he didn't know what to say.
Fortunately, I did.
We should cover our magical trail, too, I said, pulling off my poncho so I could turn it inside out. Kaufman's a good mage. I caught his bugged business card. But if he got something off me, like a hair from my apartment, he could use it to cast a finding spell that will track us anywhere. The only way to stop him is to cut the connection ahead of time.
Nick nodded.
Sounds good. How do we do that?
With this. I held up the inside of my poncho.
I didn't buy this thing for cleaning. It's actually a security garment meant for protecting high-value targets. CEOs, foreign dignitaries, that sort of thing. My mom bought it for me when I first moved to the DFC.
Then she must love you a lot,
Nick said.
I've seen those in catalogs. They're stupid expensive.
I'd never doubted that my mother loved me. It was her judgment I didn't trust. But unlike the designer clothes she still sent me every season, always one size too small, for encouragement. The poncho was actually useful, which was why it had survived long after I'd sold everything else.
It's worth the money, I said, pointing at the far more delicate ward lines that covered the poncho's interior. The outside focuses on external threats. Bullets, dirt, blunt trauma, and so on. But the interior is all about magical protection, including a burn command for separating material links.
I just had to remember how to use it.
Sybil, I said, pulling my goggles back down over my face. My AI's icon fluttered.
Oh, are you speaking to me again?
I wasn't ever not speaking to you.
That's not what it felt like to me.
I rolled my eyes at her grumpy tone. I thought AIs weren't supposed to hold grudges.
I wasn't holding a grudge, she said defensively. I was giving you your space. You always get snippy after you talk to your mother.
I couldn't deny that one, so I just moved on. I need you to look up the manual for my poncho. I can't remember the activation sequence for the material links disposal system.
Here you go,
she said, bringing up the diagram.
I highlighted the hand gestures since I know you have trouble with those.
I smiled at her thoughtfulness. This was why computer assistants were awesome. They knew you better than you knew yourself. Thank you, I said, wiggling into the inside-out poncho. The rough plastic exterior felt awful against my bare shoulders, like a combination tarp and trash bag. But at least I didn't have to bear it for long. Even without a full charge, I could feel the magic through the spellwork as I followed the diagrammed instructions my AI had projected in the air in front of me. Clear! A pulse of magic filled the car, making Nick jump.
A little warning next time, he snapped, gripping the wheel. I almost rear-ended someone.
Sorry, I coughed, waving the smoke away from my flushed face. Didn't realize I was going to do that.
I'd never used this particular feature of my poncho before. I honestly had no idea how the material link disposal spell functioned, since the whole point of owning a high-end piece of magical equipment was so I didn't have to learn how to do all this stuff myself. But my entire body felt sunburned, which I assumed meant it had worked. According to the manual, the burn-off wouldn't save me from a really strong link like blood. But all the minor connections, such as hair, skin, recently worn clothing, treasured objects, and so forth, should have been neutralized. I'll do you next when we pull over to check for bugs, I told Nick, pulling the poncho off my head again.
No, thank you,
Nick said, cringing.
Kaufman doesn't know where I live, and I didn't get close enough for him to grab anything, so I'll pass.
You should still do it, I said. Better safe than sorry.
Better anything than what just happened to you,
he said with a shudder,
shaking his head.
If it felt that awful from the outside, I don't ever want to be inside.
I hadn't thought it was that bad. But then, I'm a horrible mage. I'd backlashed myself with magic so many times I didn't even feel it anymore. Now that I thought about it, I remembered that this kind of internal magic was always way scarier for non-mages, who weren't used to having their souls moved around on the regular. No wonder Nick didn't want to do it. Your choice, I said, draping the poncho over my lap since we weren't being shot at right now, and I wanted to savor life outside a plastic bag for a while. How long are we going to drive?
Until I'm convinced there's no one following us.
Do you need me to navigate? He shook his head.
Don't need to know where you're going if your only destination is away.
I shrugged and leaned back in his seat, determined to rest if he didn't want assistance. Now that I'd stopped moving, it was starting to hit me how tired I was. Tired and hungry. According to the clock at the corner of my augmented reality vision, it was after 11. I'd gotten up at 5 to get a good spot at the morning cleaning auction, and I'd been going nonstop ever since, which meant I'd missed lunch and dinner. My stomach clenched at the reminder, but I couldn't do anything about it. I'd left my supply of cup noodles back at my apartment, and I was flat broke. Even vending machine sandwiches were out of my budget right now if I wanted to have any money left for tomorrow. So I told my stomach to STFU and leaned my head against the window of Nick's car, looking up at the night sky as we came out on the skyways to see if I could spot the moon. Living underground, I almost never got to see it. But my bad luck must still have been going strong, because the night was overcast, leaving me staring at yet another ceiling as the low clouds rolled between the brightly lit columns of the superscrapers. After an hour of driving in circles, and a very thorough check for bugs at what had to be the last petroleum pump in the DFZ, Nick finally deemed us free of tails, which meant we could move on to our actual destination, the city morgue. Today's events notwithstanding, I didn't normally encounter dead bodies, so I'd never actually been there before. I wasn't sure what I was expecting, but the giant industrial warehouse Nick pulled us up beside definitely wasn't it. Are you sure this is the right place? I asked, squinting out the window at the brightly lit white walls. It looks like an auto plant.
It has to be big,
Nick said as he cut the engine.
There's 10 million people between the underground and the skyways. Even when you account for all the ones who die in hospitals and get processed there, that's still a lot of dead bodies.
I'd never really thought about it. I supposed it was comforting to know that even in the capitalistic dystopia of the DFZ, bodies weren't left to rot in the street. The industrial scale of the facility still gave me the creeps, though, especially once I noticed the giant smokestacks rising up through a special hole in the skyways above. So what's the plan? I asked, tearing my eyes away from what had to be the biggest crematorium in North America.
Same as before. Get to the body,
Nick replied, leaning down so he could peer at the morgue's towering wall through my window.
There are thousands of corpses in there. We'll never find our mage in that haystack. So you're going to go into the office and ask Peter where he put him. Once we get the slab number, we can sneak into the main building and get the hand.
By which he meant steal. Are you sure we have to do this? I asked nervously. There has to be some other way of accessing the information in that hand that doesn't involve taking from the forgotten dead.
I already told you there isn't,
Nick said sharply.
You're the one who said the location info is hard-coded into the VCI. If you're right, then there's no way to hack into that without literally sticking a wire into the inputs. So unless you want to bring a hacker into the morgue, we need that cyberware.
I winced, fingers twisting in my lap. And Nick sighed.
Look,
he said, dragging a gloved hand through his short-cropped dark hair.
I'll do the actual snitch if you don't want to, but you're the only one who can get the info out of Peter. If I show up out of nowhere and start asking for slab numbers, he'll know something's up. But you're the one who found the body. You've got all kinds of reasons why you'd need to see it again. Just pick one and get in there. Most death priests are night owls, but it's getting close to 1 a.m. If we don't do this quick, Peter will go home, and we'll be stuck until tomorrow.
I sank deeper into my seat with every word. He was right, of course. I'd already made up my mind that I had to do this for the money. But now that I was actually here, it felt utterly wrong. I also had no idea how I was actually going to convince Peter to lead me to the body. Nick said I had all kinds of reasons, but all the ones that came to my head sounded like transparent ploys. I was going through Dr. Lyle's notes again to see if there was anything that could give me a legitimate reason for needing me to see his body again, when I found his expired ID. And got my idea. "I'll be back," I said, putting my shoes on before sliding out of the car. "Wait here." Nick nodded and settled into the driver's seat, watching me like a falcon as I walked down the street and up the stairs to what I hoped was the morgue's front office. The inside of the DFZ's clearinghouse for dead bodies turned out to be a lot more mundane than you'd expect. With its beige walls, fluorescent lights, and cheap blue carpeting, it actually looked more like a traditional government building than anything else I'd seen in this crazy city. The front steps led me up to a pair of double doors that opened into a receiving area, where a bored security guard asked me what I wanted. That was the point at which I suddenly realized I didn't actually know Peter's last name. Fortunately, despite his prominence in the DFZ, the Empty Wind didn't actually have a lot of full-time priests. The guard knew exactly who I was talking about. And a few minutes later, I was walking down the fluorescent-lit hall with a temporary visitor's stamp on my hand, counting the endless identical doors until I reached the one the guard had told me to knock on.
"Opal,"
Peter said, his face surprised when he opened his door and saw me standing outside like a guilty kid.
"What are you doing here?"
"I had a question for you," I said, trying not to fidget. "Can I come in?" Peter stepped back at once, holding the door for me. His office was surprisingly large and even more surprisingly normal. I'd been half expecting altars of bones, but his large desk was covered in a perfectly ordinary mix of publicly projected AR and good old-fashioned paper. He had several lamps to soften the harsh overhead light, and a few potted plants to make the place feel a bit less like a windowless box. There was even a cat tower in the corner, where Peter's orange tomcat was lounging on his back, watching me with curious yellow eyes as I sheepishly scuttled inside. "Sorry to bother you," I said as Peter shut the door behind me.
"No bother at all,"
he replied, pointing at one of the two padded chairs in front of his desk.
"I'm happy to have the company. I don't exactly get a lot of visitors."
I could see how someone whose clients were alone by default wouldn't have a lot of foot traffic.
"There," Peter said, sitting down in his own comfortably worn office chair. "Now, what can I do for you?"
He finished with a warm smile, which made me feel absolutely awful. Unlike mine, Peter's job was a noble calling, and here I was trying to take advantage of it. But while there was no sugarcoating the fact that I'd come here as a thief, I did have something legitimate to share with him, and I clung to that shred of decency with all I had. "Actually, I have something for you," I said, holding out Dr. Lyle's ID. He took it curiously.
"Who's this?"
"The man you recovered from the apartment this morning," I replied. "He was Dr. Theodore Lyle, a professor of thaumaturgy, or at least a former one." An exultant grin spread over Peter's face.
"Where did you find this?"
"In the unit," I said, which wasn't technically a lie. I had found it while cleaning, just not in the place I was implying.
"Thank you so much for bringing this to me," he said,
putting the ID on his desk so he could take a picture of it with his phone.
It will help enormously.
Glad to hear it, I said, trying not to sound too excited as I moved on to my real object. So now that we know who he is, he's no longer one of the forgotten dead, right? Peter shook his head.
That's for the empty wind to decide. I just do the grunt work.
But we know who he is now, I argued. How can he be forgotten if he's known?
Knowing isn't the same as remembering, Peter explained, taking one more picture of the back of the ID before sliding the card into a manila folder marked Pending. We know who he was, but we don't know him. Not like family or a friend would. But this is still fantastic. Even a little remembrance can help keep a soul together on the other side. The world of spirits is not a kind or gentle place. It's the source of all magic in the world, and the torrents of power there will shred a human soul in seconds if it's not properly protected by the memories of those who knew them. It's not as good as the love of a relative, but just the two of us knowing Dr. Lyle's name can still be a shield for him in the swirling void. It'll also make Collection's job a lot easier when they search for his next of kin.
He beamed at me.
You did a very good thing bringing this to me, Opal. The dead and I thank you.
His heartfelt gratitude made me feel 10 times worse than if he'd yelled at me, as did the fact that none of this was going according to plan. I'd hoped that Peter would see the ID and proclaim that Dr. Lyle was no longer forgotten, which meant taking his hand would be just the normal sort of illegal, and not stealing from a death god. Clearly this wasn't going to be as simple as I'd hoped. But I wasn't giving up yet. So what happens to him now? I asked, finally sitting down in the chair he'd offered when I'd walked in. Are you holding his body in case any relatives come looking?
Normally we would, Peter said. But his body was so decayed, I decided cremation would be kinder. He's in the queue for the ovens right now.
My heart skipped a beat. But you haven't burned him yet, right?
I'm not sure, Peter said,
giving me a curious look.
Why do you ask?
I was just wondering, I said, keeping my voice desperately casual. What about organ donations? Peter chuckled.
Hopeful. He was dead for 30 days before you found him. I don't think they'll be getting any viable organs out of that.
What about cybernetics? I pressed. He had a cybernetic hand, didn't he? Surely you don't burn that.
Normally, no. But he came in with the empty wind. When that happens, we burn everything the living would have considered their body to make sure that nothing they might need is left behind.
Peter's eyes narrowed suspiciously.
Why the sudden curiosity? Is there something of his you want?
This was where I could have played the ruthless, greedy cleaner and claimed I wanted the cybernetics for resale. But that was so shameless that I couldn't even get the words out of my mouth. I don't want anything, I lied, pulling the notes I'd taken out of my bag. It's just that I was going through his spell notes, and I found some stuff that looked like it was meant specifically to get around the casting limitations caused by having a fake hand. I've never seen anything like it, so I wanted to examine his fingers to see if they matched the description of the altered motions in the spell. That was the biggest BS I'd ever spewed in my life. I didn't even know if spells could be modified to account for cybernetics, but it sounded plausible. And it gave me an innocent reason to look at Dr. Lyle's body. I was congratulating myself on my fast thinking when Peter suddenly rose from his desk.
Why didn't you just say so?
He asked, giving me a smile.
I can take you down myself right now. If Dr. Lyle hasn't gone into the oven yet, you're free to look over him all you want.
I smiled back, panicking inside. If Peter was with me, there was no way Nick or I could steal the hand. But while I was scrambling to think of how I was going to salvage the situation, Sybil's voice whispered confidently in my ear. I've got this. Peter's phone rang the moment she finished. Flashing me an apologetic smile, he picked it up, sitting back down at his desk so he could access his computer.
Office of the Forgotten Dead. Peter speaking.
What followed was a conversation too low for me to hear. It must have been very serious business, though, because Peter's normally cheerful face grew dire.
Of course,
he said, scribbling an address down on the yellow sticky pad beside him.
I'll head over right now.
What did you do? I typed to Sybil on my AR keyboard.
Called in an emergency,
my AI replied smugly.
Now he'll be out of your hair.
The horror I felt at that must have been loud and clear on the surface brainwave she had access to, because Sybil's voice grew instantly calm and cajoling. Before she could explain herself, though, Peter hung up and turned to me.
I have to go,
he said, his voice deadly serious.
If I give you the slab number, will you be all right checking the body by yourself?
I'll be fine, I said, happy to let him assume my shaking voice was nerves over being alone in a morgue and not crippling guilt. What's the number? He wrote it down on another sticky note and handed it to me.
I'm so sorry to leave you in the lurch. I'd tell you to come back later so I could guide you myself, but I don't know how long this will take. And there's no stopping the cremation queue. I'd hate for any part of Dr. Lyle's legacy to be lost because you were waiting for me. Just tell the front guard I said it was okay, and he'll let you in. Again, I'm really sorry about this.
Not half as sorry as I felt. Thank you, Peter, I said, taking the sticky note. I owe you big time.
Not as much as we owe you,
he assured me, grabbing his bag and holding out his arm so that his cat could climb onto his shoulder.
You're the one investigating his spells. The things we create in this life are so much more important than our names. By pouring your energy and interest into something Dr. Lyle made, you honor his memory and keep his flame alive. I couldn't ask for a greater service to the Forgotten Dead.
I couldn't even fake a smile after that. I followed him out of his office feeling like an absolute villain. Fortunately, Peter was too busy to notice. He was already jogging away down the hall, calling for the service mechanic to get his truck pulled around.
Sybil, I hissed when he was gone. Why are you mad at me?
My AI cried.
I exist to help you, and it's not as if I put the priest in danger. I just sent him on a wild goose chase. By the time he gets back, you'll have the hand and the corpse will be in the cooker. No one will even know what happened.
That did sound like a pretty clean getaway. But even though everything was now going as well as I could have wished, it felt like the world was collapsing on my head. I'm going to get cursed forever, I groaned, pulling out my phone to message Nick to meet me at the front. The empty wind's going to damn my soul, and Peter's going to hate me.
Peter will never know,
Sybil said confidently.
And the empty wind probably isn't even paying attention. He only cares about the Forgotten Dead. You're alive and remembered. You'll be fine.
As an AI, Sybil was the least qualified entity to give her opinion on mortal spirits. But there was no point in arguing. I was already deep in the hole. Might as well get what I'd paid for. So with that, I sucked it up and marched back to the front door to signal Nick.